It may be an interesting thing at my age, as I was saying to a group yesterday, that 85 is an important year. In the beginning, it's the days that count. Oh, he's 3 days old already. And then it's the weeks, and then it's the years. When you reach my category, it's every 5 years. So 85 is more important than 84. And 86 won't matter at all. When I reach 90, if I do, that'll be another important year. Fadingly so, I'm afraid, but anyway. It's interesting now to take stock of my life, and I hope you'll go along with me on this little adventure. Because as I look back, of course I have a lot to be grateful for, but it began somewhere. A tree doesn't grow without roots. And the roots in this case were a real desire for truth. I remember my dad telling me, we were out in the on the porch of our house in Teleogin. I was 5 years old. And he was saying that in the beginning, the rulers of this planet were the reptiles, the dinosaurs. And then it became the whatever it was, animals. Now the man. And someday birds will probably become the rulers of the planet. And I thought then, well, is it only a matter of chance? There's birds and men and so on. There's got to be some meaning to it all. I wasn't satisfied. And I remember at Christmas that year, my dad was shaving and I was in the bathroom with him. And I said to him, "Dad, there really isn't a Santa Claus, is there?" And he didn't want to dispel the sweet myth of childhood, so he sort of equivocated. And I understood immediately. Of course there couldn't be. I mean, one person can't go around to every house in the world, and not every house has a chimney. And so, after all that reasoning, I thought, well, it's much more fun to believe in Santa Claus, so I'll believe in him anyway. So there are some things I believe in just because it's fun to believe in. Life without fun is no good. But still, I knew that there was no such thing. In other words, my search for truth was not a grim thing. I had a lot of fun seeking it, but I was always seeking out the little corners of what can be true, what may not be true, what is, what isn't. And I remember my brother when I was, he was 3 and I was 5, I think again, or 6, I don't know. Anyway, a little caterpillar on the road. And he picked up the caterpillar and said, "There, there, you little worm, let me put you on the side so nothing no one will step on you," which was sweet. And I found myself thinking, well, if I had picked up that worm, I would wonder why that one worm of all worms had to be on a path and get stepped on, and what would make it be stepped on. This is just the way I couldn't help being. In my past lives, Master said you were eaten up with doubts, and I was filled with doubts. But you know, the wonderful thing about a fault, and this is something for you to remember, any fault that you have, anything that you're trying to overcome, it's like a bone. When you break a bone, the bone that forms around that break is stronger than the regular bone. And so the faults that you have, when they become virtues, become a strong virtue. They're your strong point, you might say. So your greatest failings will become your greatest help when you overcome it. It's a very encouraging thought. God doesn't damn you. God wants you to succeed. And the thing is, when you do succeed, you become much better for having had that fault. So don't worry about it. Everything comes out all right in the end. And what was that cartoon you saw, Jyotish? God separating the light from the dark. over a laundry machine, the light food. Light. Anyway, when I reached the age of 13, I was thinking in terms of what will I do for a living. And I thought of becoming an astronomer, because the beauty of the stars really was beautiful. And I was grinding a 6-inch mirror for a telescope, and I worked on it for 6 months, and then after 6 months it fell off the table and cracked, and I ruined it. And that sort of discouraged me. But I had also reached the point where I thought, well, astronomers are always concerned about formulae and statistics and so on. And I don't want to think that way. I want to think of the beauty of it. So what in human life helps to inspire a sense of beauty and meaning and so on? And I thought, well, maybe the arts. Mind you, I didn't think about God, because to me, I went to the Episcopal Church, and I have to say that God, the Episcopal Church makes God so boring. I wanted nothing to do with him. And so I tried to find every possible way of discovering truth without having to depend on God. And if I had been brought up anything else, maybe I'd be better off, I don't know. But anyway, then I thought through some political system, and I thought of communism and so on, different methods that would ensure human happiness. And I realized that people are only as happy as they themselves are. No system's going to make you better. And communism, my parents went to Romania after the war. And this was not after the war, but already I was studying a little bit of it. And I saw that they weren't making people happy. They were only bossing people. The communist system is really not for the people. It's for the bosses. It's a complete scam. And so I left that. And then I thought of the arts. And I thought of music. And I used to play the piano for many hours a day. And music was a very important part of my life. But finally I thought, well, it doesn't make me a better person. The kind of music I was playing, it was classical. But I remember at the age of 18, I studied singing. My teacher wanted me to be a great singer, as she put it. I thought, what for? What's the use of showing off my voice? Besides, what is there to sing? You sing these classical songs and you think, wow, that has deep meaning. Oh, cessate di piagarmi, oh, lasciatemi morir. If you understand the meaning, all it is saying is, stop bugging me and let me die. What kind of a message is that? Absolutely useless. And so I gave up singing. And I remember one night I was in Charleston, South Carolina. I had thought to become a playwright. And writing was sort of a natural thing, the sort of thing one is born with. I remember at the age of 7, my parents corrected me. You know how children will say, and this, and this, and this? Well, I had done that. They said, you don't need to. Oh, how nice of it. Oh, it's not quite empty. They corrected me. They said, you shouldn't use all those ends. Make fewer ends. I knew they were right. There was no question in my mind about it. But I myself was amused at my instinctive reaction, which was, who is anybody to tell me how to write? And so you can tell from tendencies like that, the first thing I used to write was plays, dialogue. And the first piece of literature I wrote was a play, The Peace Treaty. Not the one you know, but the first version at the age of 15. So gradually, I came to the point where I realized that I intensely wanted not only to find truth, but to share with everybody whatever I found. And I looked over history, and I just had to admit that the only people who had really helped humanity in the long term were the prophets, the saints. And I thought, well, how is that possible? And finally, I came to the point where every argument I was following led in the conclusion that there has to be a God. There has to be some intelligent guiding force. And I walked out one night in Charleston, where I'd been studying stage techniques. And I asked myself, if there's a God, what must he be? And I thought, well, he can't be a policeman or a judge waiting for man to make a mistake so he can just, oh, I knew you were like that, clap him into hell for eternity. That just didn't make any sense at all. And I thought, well, then who is it asking this question? What makes me ask this question? If I were a robot, I couldn't be programmed to ask this question. People nowadays talk about computers someday demanding computer rights. There are two things science will never be able to duplicate: feeling and self-awareness. And so I was thinking, okay, I'm asking this question, therefore I'm intelligent. And he has to be the source of that intelligence. And if he is, then I'm a part of that intelligence. I'm manifesting him. And then I remembered standing on the beach, above the beach, on a little walkway in the south part of Charleston, looking at the waves coming in. And there were rocks on the shore. And when the rocks were close together, the waves only had a narrow channel. But when there was a broader channel, because the rocks were farther apart, more water could come in. And I thought, well, that's what I have to do. I have to open my mind to that flow. And the more open I am to God, the more he will be able to come into me and change me. And I noticed those things that kept me from seeking him or kept me from being clear mentally were shutting him out. If I drank and became somewhat muddy in my thinking, that was shutting him out. And so in different ways I saw that the goal of life, not only for me but for everybody, has to be the same. We have to understand how to open ourselves to that truth. And I was absolutely staggered by the immensity of this realization. I had never read the lives of saints. When my mother talked about the miracles of saints, I would say to her, come off it, mother. This is just ridiculous. But suddenly I realized this has to be the meaning of it all. I didn't know about saints, as I said. And therefore I thought, inevitably, that no one's ever thought this way before. And for a while I thought, am I going crazy? And I remember going upstate New York, trying to find the peace of mind and the happiness and harmony that I was looking for in the beauty of nature. And I saw a drop of water, a dewdrop, on a pine needle. And I thought, that's beautiful. The rainbow colors are beautiful. But I can't feel it. There's something wrong with me. And therefore, I'm the one who has to be changed. It doesn't matter about nature, whether I'm in nature or in the lowest part of Harlem. I'm the one who needs to change. And so I just could not get away from this final discovery that I had to give my life to God. I didn't know that God would answer me, but honestly, he did help me very much. I had never wanted a guru. I never knew the meaning of guru. All I knew was that no one I'd ever met seemed to know anything worth knowing. And so I didn't want anything that they had to give me. But when I was at this point, my father had been sent to Egypt, and my mother was to join him. I think it was Divine Mother who sent him to Egypt, because he worked for Esso. He was an oil geologist. And where he was sent, usually he would find oil. And he found oil. He found where oil would be found in Egypt, And Mobile came in later and did find oil just where he said they would find it. But Esso suddenly changed their mind and sent him to France. So he never finished that job. And the day I put my mother on the ship to go join him, Divine Mother didn't waste any time. I came from the docks and came uptown New York and discovered Autobiography of a Yogi. And that book completely changed my life. I read it. I said, that's for me. And I took the next bus across the country. And as I was crossing the country, I thought, this is such a wonderful truth. I want to share it with everybody. But the first words I addressed to Master when I met him were, I want to be your disciple. And I've been that ever since. He always groomed me because he saw in me this desire to share with other people too. And he groomed me for that. I was only 22 when I met him. And I was still 22 when it was my job at the time to send announcements to the papers to tell who would be talking in which church on the next Sunday. And so I knew that Master was scheduled to speak in San Diego. And I thought how happy those people will be, because he hadn't been there for 2 months. And they were told to look in the papers and see when he was coming, and then he would be there. And so I was really feeling very happy for them that finally he'd go back there. When Saturday morning, Reverend Bernard came into my room and said, Master can't go. He wants you to go in there in his place. 22 years. I'd never lectured in my life. And here I was to take his place. And worse still, he wanted me to give a Kriya initiation to only one person, but still, a Kriya initiation. I'd only attended one initiation already. And really, it was sort of like the bird being kicked out of its nest so it'll fly. And so, you know, the church's course was completely full. And they had this system then where the curtains were closed. And when the curtains opened, the minister was standing in the center. So they didn't even know that Master wouldn't be there until the curtains opened. And there was this little, I've often thought of a clashing cymbals and crashing chords, and then suddenly this little mouse comes in. And so, and anyway, I was there, and I looked. The church was completely packed. Standing room at the back, people looking in the window. There couldn't have been more people. And you know, I wasn't at all nervous because I was thinking, these poor people. I was so disappointed for them. But somehow it worked all right and everything came out. I've never been nervous. And this is another thing that's worth knowing, because they say that being nervous in when public speaking is one of the greatest fears of people, that people have, the fear of speaking in public. But I only think about what I can give to people. I don't think about what they think of me. They can think I'm a complete idiot. It doesn't matter to me, because I want truth. And if I'm an idiot, then it doesn't hurt if I know it. And if it isn't true, then what does it matter what they think? And so I just don't bother about that thought. But I try to help them to understand. I remember for years I would sit in a room off the main room when people were coming in to hear a lecture of mine. And I would think, what do these people need to hear? And I'd try to tune into them and give them what they needed. Not that oh, you want a green suit, come over here under the green light. I didn't mean it that way. What they really want in a genuine way, what I can give them in a genuine way, not like a salesman, but like someone who is trying to help them where they are to see what the next step up is. And in this way, I did my best. Master was all for it. I remember I was standing outside the main building, Mount Washington, with Herbert Fried from Phoenix. And Master was in the car and about to go out. But he was giving Herbert some last-minute advice on how to conduct his church where he was being sent in Phoenix. And then he paused a while and he said, "You have a great work to do." So I turned to Herbert with to felicitate him. And Master said, "It's you I'm talking to, Walter." Walter was the name he called me. And from then on, several times he said, "You have a great work to do." And I remember one time he said, "Of all the men apart from St. Lin, every man has disappointed me, and you mustn't disappoint me." And he spoke with great power. And I realized he did have something he wanted me to do. It wasn't that other men had disappointed him spiritually. I knew that. What he meant was that male energy tends to go more outward. Female energy tends to draw more inward. And it takes masculine energy to get a work out into the world. And he saw that desire in me to reach out to people. And he wanted me to understand that he was counting on me to take his message out. Well, when he died, I did my best. But the feminine energy was in control. And they kept thinking, why can't he just wait to be told what to do? And here I was sitting on a volcano of energy that wanted to do this and do that. And I drove them crazy and they drove me crazy. And finally, I remember, the thing was in Delhi, when I went back to India, I didn't want to continue the work in Calcutta because they were all a bunch of old people sleeping. And it was such old energy, I just couldn't get anything going there. When I went to Delhi, Patiala, Shimla, other towns in the north, I found a lot of interest. 2,000 people would come. And I thought, well, if I can do something, and I asked Dayamata, and she said, "Yes, try it." So when I went to India, to Delhi, I tried to get land there for an ashram. They said, "Absolutely not, impossible." And they said that ashrams have the last priority. First come hospitals, businesses, all sorts of things. But ashrams, we have too many in India. So they actually laughed at me. And I said, "By my will, I'm going to make this happen." And I tried to understand what they wanted. And I tried to find the land that I wanted so I could visualize it. Well, I went out to the Green Belt area. That seemed the best place. But the rule for a Green Belt area was fixed, and there was no breaking that rule. So I thought, well, why do they have that rule? I discovered a part just the Green Belt sort of came in, made a loop toward the center of the city, and just next to Birla Mandir, there was land there across from what they called Lover's Lane at the time. There was a property that it was good. Just across the street from that, there was a yoga ashram. And I said, well, this area here is perfect for what I want. So I thought, that's what I'm going to get. Well, just at that time, a Mr. Gupta came to me and he said, "I can get you that yoga ashram." I said, "I don't want to take somebody else's ashram from him. I won't do it." And he couldn't believe. He was a Pakabanya, which means to say a real merchant. And so he just couldn't imagine I was serious. So he said, "All I need, I've studied their bylaws. I'm going to get enough members to vote the old people out and vote you in." And I said, "I don't want it. I won't take anything on those circumstances." And anyway, 2 months later, he came in proudly. He said, "Swamiji, the ashram is yours." I said, "I won't take it. You can do with it what you like. I will not take anything under such adharmic circumstances." And so I don't know what happened to it. It doesn't even exist now. And it might have been a good thing, but I would not do it adharmically. But I studied the situation, and I realized that they called it a green belt area, but it wasn't green at all at the time. It was just sand and shrubs, dry shrubs, nothing green about it, really. A sort of occasional unhappy tree, you might say. And I finally wrote a letter to Bhagavan Sahaya, who was the chief commissioner of Delhi State. And I said that you want this to be a green belt area, but it's anything except that. He said if you would let organizations build parks of their own, they could make them beautiful. You could have beautiful greenery there. But nobody's going to make a park if you can't have a few buildings. I said, you yourselves have your Buddha Jayanti Park, but you make it possible for people to come in the Greenbelt area by having a restaurant and restrooms and a few little buildings there. And they're well adaptable because the rest of the park is completely green. So I said, why not let organizations do that? You'll have to let them have some buildings, but even so, they'll build greenery. So anyway, he called me to his house. He said, I'm well impressed with this idea, and I like it. I can sway the other commissioners to it, but you'll have to get permission. I said, well, you can get it. Oh, no. He said, I won't touch it. He said, this decision has come down from the top level of government. You have to talk to Pandit Nehru, who was the prime minister. And Nehru had sort of a temper, and he didn't want to face that temper, I guess. Anyway, I said, all right, I've come this far, something will happen. It was like saying, go to the moon and then we'll talk. But the people I was staying with were Kashmiri Brahmins, and they were close friends, or at least they knew a cousin of Nehru. So we went to see this old lady, and she liked my idea, and she said, well, she'll recommend that I talk to Indira Gandhi, the daughter of Nehru. So when I went to Indira Gandhi, she was seeing me only out of a sense of duty to this auntie of hers. And so she was rather a haughty woman, and she said, be quick, I'm going to Paris tomorrow. I have no time for this. And I said, you're going to Paris, do you speak French? Yes. So I spoke French with her, and I talked in French all the time from then on, because I grew up with French was one of the languages I grew up with. And so I said, where did you learn French? Oh, you'd never have heard of it. Well, I said, try me. So she said, well, it was a little village in Switzerland called Villar. I said, I went to school right next to that school. I went to school in Chaisière. We used to walk past your school every day. Well, at this point, she completely melted. And she became very friendly, and she took me out into the garden and showed me a couple of tiger cubs that someone had given her. You know, such is the strange story, the winding path of karma. I met the son of the man many years later, just recently, the son of the man who had given those tiger cubs to Nehru. Interesting. It was in Pune. Anyway, she said yes, she would see Nick. She would talk to her father about my request. So I went. Nehru would see people on his way to the office every morning, and I stood there, and I know that a picture tells more than a 1,000 words, so I had painted a big design of what I wanted with this land, which caught his attention, and he agreed to see me. And the day that he did see me, he had lost a dear friend to death, and he was more thoughtful than usual, and less irascible, you might say. And so he listened to me. He gave me, in fact, 40 minutes of his time, which was inconceivable. That was more time than he gave to ambassadors. And he said, yes, I like your idea. I will walk around the land there and and if it receives my approval, you will hear from me. So really, it was a miracle. 1,700 other designs for other societies had tried to get land in the Greenbelt area. Every one of them had been refused, and I was accepted. So of course I was thrilled, and I wrote to Mount Washington about this. They were absolutely outraged. How had I dared to do this without board approval and board thinking and board everything? And really, that was the cause of my dismissal from SRF. Things went worse and worse and worse. And finally, a year later, I was summoned to New York, a safe 3,000 miles from Los Angeles. I thought, why New York? And I went to the Penta Hotel with them, and they didn't even speak on the way back by taxi from the airport to the hotel. Tara only looked out the window and pointed out the relative positions of Saturn and Jupiter. She was very into astrology. And the next day I got this big, bulky, single page, 30 pages, single spaced, 30 page letter telling me I was through with SRF. And I got to see them, and I was kneeling on my knees before them with my hands like this, pleading with them not to so destroy my life. And I said to Tara that the things you're saying are not true. I don't want your opinions. And that was the kind of talk the whole thing was. It was extremely painful. Everything they could possibly think of to say, they said. And I was left with only the money in my wallet in New York, a safe 3,000 miles from Los Angeles, and Tara telling me, just take any job that comes along. Well, my life was dedicated to serving Master. I didn't know what else to do. I didn't want to do anything else. For me, the thought of getting a job to support myself was absolutely unthinkable. And, well, God took care of that one, too. My parents were in Europe. The day they threw me out, my parents landed on the shores of America in New York. And I was able to find them. And they were in Scarsdale, where we had our home. And I met them in New York, and I drove across the country. And I got to California. They lived in Atherton, south of San Francisco. And I phoned Daya, because Tara and Daya were my dearest friends. I had always thought of them as such. I had complete faith in them and loved them. It was really a very painful experience. Now I can look back and say it's the best thing that ever happened to me. But it didn't seem that way then. And I called Daya on the phone, and she said, "You've landed right on our doorstep!" As if it was my fault that I had come from New York, where they had dumped me, and come back to California. It was just a hopeless situation. But I never wanted to do anything to hurt them. I was very anxious not to do anything that would rival them and anything that would damage them. I very much wanted to support what they were doing. And I remember I was looking for ways to serve Master, and I was in Yosemite. I think it was 1964, and I saw a couple of young men sitting on the railing of a bridge, and they had a guitar and they were singing. Well, I was a singer, and I said, "Would you like me to sing something?" And they said, "Oh, yeah, sure." They weren't even singing in tune. It was a relief to them. So anyway, I sang "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot," which seemed to me something partially spiritual. And they were so excited. They said, "Oh, you've got to come and sing for a party we're having tonight." So I came and sang for the party. And the next day I was driving back. And I suddenly thought, well, this would be one way I could serve. They're not doing this sort of thing. And I sort of envisioned myself traveling around the country singing to people. But what am I going to sing? Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, there's a minimum of teaching in that. And what else is there? Drunk last night, drunk the night before. I just didn't. Oh, Chisati di Pyagami, I couldn't sing that. I couldn't sing bhajans. I couldn't sing master's chants to an ordinary audience. And I just didn't know what to do. And so I was about to give up the idea when suddenly the thought popped into my mind, maybe I could write my own songs. And as soon as I thought that, this song came fully clothed, you might say, into my mind. And I stopped at a milkshake stand and wrote the song down. I knew music notation, wrote it down on a paper napkin, and I kind of liked it. It was, I Have a Love That's Far Away, which you all know. And from then on, I began writing songs. I remember one other time I was coming down from Yosemite, and the rain was coming so hard that I couldn't see 50 feet down the highway. And I was getting frustrated because I had an appointment, but I couldn't drive fast. And then the thought came to me, well, if I can't have good weather outwardly, I can create my good weather inwardly. And as soon as I thought that, the song came, there's joy in the heavens, a smile on the mountains, and melody sings everywhere. And so I wrote that song. And after I had written, Walk Like a Man was one of the first ones, and I had written about five songs about. And somebody heard me sing and said, would you like to give a concert for our Unitarian Church? Well, I picked up the guitar. My brother had left a guitar at my parents' house, and he let me have it. And so I decided to learn how to play the guitar. I had been learning, not playing, learning, for 4 weeks when they made this request. And I thought, well, takes a certain amount of chutzpah to give a concert when I've only been playing the guitar for 4 weeks. But I thought, well, at least it'll make me practice. So I really practiced. My fingers were numb from the strings here. But I gave the concert. It was, the hall was full, 200 people. They wanted to create a sense of atmosphere. So they turned all the lights out. And there was one candle burning on a mantelpiece. And the mantelpiece and the candle, which is the more important word, were behind me. If there was one thing I desperately needed, it was the ability to see these strings. And I remember somebody afterwards said that, you know, I'm a music major at Cal State, and those are some pretty interesting chords you... Anyway, I pulled it off. And from then on, I did this only because SRF wasn't doing it and I wanted to do it. From the age of 15, I first wanted to start a community when I was 15. This had always been a desire of mine. I felt that it was a very needed thing in the world. And so I realized that I remembered Master talked very strongly about communities from almost the beginning of his mission in America. And during the Depression years, and I remember the Myers Garden Party, when he talked about communities, it was quite a scene. It was in Beverly Hills, and all sorts of famous rock stars, movie stars and people like that were there, about 800 people at this garden party. And then the hostess, Mrs. Myers, asked Master to speak. Well, you know how people normally in such a position would comport themselves. They'd thank the hostess and thank the audience and thank everybody and thank God I'm out of here, and that would be about it. That was not the way he talked at all. He got up there and, totally ignoring the normal behavior at such a meeting, he started in, this day marked the beginning of a new era. My words, I'm sowing my words in the ether, and they shall not die. And he talked with more power than I've ever heard anybody speak before in my life. And he was saying thousands of youths must go north, south. I remember I was giving a sermon, service at the Expanding Light, and Nirmala, forgive me, Nirmala, was there. And she was reading from my book, and she was saying, and thousands of youths must go north, south. I said, give me that book. Thousands of youths must go north, south, east, west, everywhere. My God, what a powerful talk it was. And I said to Diamata, when are we going to start these communities? She said, frankly, I'm not interested. Well, I can't imagine why she wouldn't be interested. She knew the way he'd been talking about these things. I think she changed his teachings right and left to suit what she wanted. But at any rate, I thought, they're not doing it, I can do it. So I started communities. And everything that I've done has been done really, it's the best thing they ever did. Put me out on my own, where I could think on my own and didn't have to submit my thoughts to a committee. It was really, it's been a great blessing. Painful, yes, certainly, but well worth it. I wouldn't have all of you here, and you wouldn't have me. Anyway, over the years, I have learned many things. And one of them is that you don't have to attain bliss. You are bliss. If you can get rid of the covers, it's like gold underground. And a bar of gold with 6 inches of dirt over it. And if you can dig away all that dirt and find that gold, that's what it is, finding bliss. Get rid of those things that prevent you from feeling that bliss. Selfishness, ego, desire, attachment, wish to harm people, wish to get even. I've never had those qualities, but I've had my share of whatever it took not to feel bliss. Although basically I've always been a happy person, but lately, in the recent years, I've felt this bliss coming out. And sometimes it's difficult even to speak because it just is so great. And I had this thought that they say God created the universe because he wanted to experience his joy in everyone. That didn't satisfy me. So Yukteswar said, I'd leave a few questions to be answered in the divine. And that didn't quite satisfy me. I needed something that would satisfy my intellect. And it came to my mind that the very nature of bliss is to express itself. Bliss is created by nature. You don't sit there hugging it. You just have to give it out. And so God, as Satchidananda, absolute conscious bliss, is bound to want to express himself from time to time in a day of Brahma. And you know, you look at people everywhere, as Lord Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, get away from this ocean of suffering and misery. And yes, people do suffer. But you know, the end of the story of every soul is absolute bliss. It's a wonderful thing. This is implanted in every human being, because we are all manifestations of that bliss. And so we're all looking for it, and we look for it in wrong ways. And so it takes many, many, and I don't want to have to tell you how many, lifetimes to find God. But it always takes that long. Because first people try through power, through greed, through revenge, through all the different things. But you know, the worst criminal, he's only seeking bliss. He's just seeking it wrongly, and he will suffer. But in the end, everybody has to reach the point that I reached, that you've all reached, that you know that what you're looking for is that bliss. And it's a wonderful story. When you look at the end of the story of every life and realize that everybody will come out into that absolute bliss and realize that that is what his life is all about. You were born for bliss. You were born to live in bliss. You were born to merge in bliss. So don't worry about the tests. There's a beautiful story that Master used to tell about Saint Teresa of Avila, who had many tests. And one day she was crossing a stream. She was an old woman by that time, and the stream was in spate, and the horse lost its footing and swept her down the stream, and all her nuns thought, oh, she's drowned now. But in fact, she found herself on the other bank, and her clothes were completely dry, and Jesus was standing there before her, and he said, don't feel too badly, Teresa. This is how I treat all my friends. And she said, oh, my Lord, no wonder you have so few. But in fact, Master said, living for God is martyrdom. It's a painful process, but painful only to the ego. You've got to fiercely get rid of this thought of ego. When you can get rid of that and realize that you are only an instrument of that infinite bliss, then you find freedom. So if there's anything I can tell you today that is important, don't worry about the tests. Don't concentrate on the difficulties. Don't concentrate on anything except the chance to find that bliss and to be that bliss. You are that bliss. Joy to all.